This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Aaron Burr served as third vice president of the United States under Thomas Jefferson. A lot of controversy that surrounds his memory. As you know, he killed fellow founding father Alexander Hamilton in a duel in 1804, and he won supporters but also political enemies for his progressive views on slavery and gender equality. Burr's personal life is less well known. He fathered only one child who survived birth, a daughter named Theodosia. She grew into a learned and cultured young lady. In 1801, she wed Joseph Alston, who had become governor of South Carolina. But shortly after Alston's election, Theodosia boarded a ship traveling from South Carolina to New York and was never heard from again. Historians theorize her vessel was either shipwrecked or captured by pirates who likely murdered everyone on board. In his new novel called The Watery Part of the World, novelist Michael Parker imagines what became of Theodosia, Burr Alston. In the book, she survives the ship's fate and lives out the rest of her life on an island in North Carolina's Outer Banks. Michael Parker marries Theodosia's fictional fate with another historical narrative, the lives of three townspeople who lived mostly in isolation on a small barrier island off the Carolina coast. The Watery Part of the World is a sweeping saga that spans generations of people who are eternally bound to each other by their island home. And I'm pleased to welcome Michael Parker back to the program today to tell us more about the book. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What attracted you to the story of Theodosia Burr Alston?
Well, actually, it came from a book called Myths and Legends of North Carolina, which I used to read to my daughter when she was younger. I'd heard the story, and I obviously knew about Aaron Burr, but I really knew nothing about the circumstances of her disappearance. And, you know, when people disappear, writers are all over that, you know. when you don't know what happened to someone, right, and you just know the very basic, rudimentary facts of their life, and then there's nothing but mystery, it's just an open invitation for writers to take off where what we know ends and just invent stuff.
Well, it's kind of interesting to think about the added interest it might have held for you seeing your daughter's reactions. I mean, you're channeling not only your curiosity, but hers as well. It might intensify.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think she was interested in it because, well, the actual story posited several theories about her turning up on the Outer Banks or being taken in by pirates, and so what I ended up writing was like a combination of all those things, and then a lot of other stuff that I was interested in, and that seemed to arise out of her character, and also the character of the island, because the islands, as you probably understood from reading the book, are as much a presence as the right, people who live on them.
Will you read for us?
Certainly. I'll read from a section early on in the book where Theodosia is, her ship is boarded by pirates led by a pirate named Daniels. Daniels had stood calmly among the carnage on deck. He was bare to the waist and there was an epaulette of blood on his shoulder. "She wouldn't let go her picture," said one of the men. "Did you not try cutting off her arm?" said Daniels. "We figured you want a taste first." The bloody-shouldered leader reached out to her. She said to the woman in the portrait, "I am the daughter of Aaron Burr." "What'd she say?" one of the men behind her whispered. "She said she's Aaron Burr's daughter," said the leader. "The one that killed that fellow in the duel?" The leader put a bloody hand on her shoulder. He said, as she drew his sword, that he did not care if she was a queen of bloody England. She smiled at the woman in the portrait, who said, "Stay with me, Theo. I will not let them harm you." "I will stay with you," she said. Past the woman, beyond the gray horizon, a blue line of hills arose, and in the middle distance, the lushly treed forest lining the bank across the Hudson came slowly into focus. Smoke from the chimneys of Richmond Hill, under a canopy of linden trees in the garden she dined with her father. "I brought you this gift," she said to him. "I've come home to be with you now. Never again will we be parted." She extended the portrait to her father. "Let her go," said Daniels, a creaking as his sword found refuge in its sheath. She felt the fingers on her shoulder loosen and fall away. "Go where?" said a voice behind. "Take her ashore," he said. "She's our burden now. We cannot touch her because she's already been touched by God."
Michael Parker reading from his new novel, The Watery Part of the World. Interesting how her feigning insanity is what saves her, but it also is her entree into this new world. It's a kind of an interesting thought because, as you say, the island, the place, is a very important character.
Mm-hmm.
It's her relationship with the place. And she has to change from a privileged young woman to someone who can actually make a living on this new island, this new space that doesn't care who she is and where
right.
she's from. And you really need to make a kind of a mental break. You need to be a little nuts to be able to go from one to the other.
Yeah, I think she gives up a lot of her personality. I mean, she has to kind of totally indoctrinate herself in a new way of living and in order to survive, which actually has been disarming and unsettling to some readers who see this woman who's like, you know, sort of the prototype for Mary Wollstonecraft's ideas about education for women in that part of the in that time
right.
period, who then turns out to be just someone who's hoeing in her garden and making sure that everybody's fed and mending nets. But I didn't actually mean it to be a comment upon, you know, I wasn't trying to attack, you know, ideas of how to educate women, but just to take her particular story and to try to imagine what it must have been like for her to survive.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's the problem we all have. If you're trying to make a transition from one state to another, whatever that threshold might be, you know, if your mind doesn't change, if you don't start seeing yourself in a new way, it's really hard to make a new life for yourself.
Exactly. And there's a lot in the book about, on the more contemporary side, people are talking about the three characters on the island talk a lot about whether or not you're too old to change or too ornery to change. So the whole notion of what it takes to change in order to adapt to a new way of living is very much present in the book throughout.
And the book spans generations. You intertwine Theodosia's disappearance with another nugget of history. Tell us about the three townspeople who were the last to leave. This was the island in 1970.
Right. That actually is also based on a historical fact, which I wrote a story that was in my last collection called Off Island. And it was about these three people, two elderly white women and an elderly black man who sort of took care of them. And they were the last to leave this island in the Outer Banks that had been just destroyed basically by hurricanes and lost its economic viability because of the way the hurricanes changed the configuration of the harbor so that the boats could no longer access the deep water. And I didn't really know. I mean, I wrote that story. I thought it was a story, but it needled me for years. I had a kind of structural anxiety about it because I felt like it was really not fully doing what a story should do, which is to focus on a moment rather than a long span of time and the way in which time affects character, which is what novels do, as opposed to stories, which are just sort of brief flashes and that are very important moments in someone's life, but you know, don't encapsulate the whole history.
Right.
So I realized that that story wasn't finished. So I kept working on it, and I finished a novella, but I didn't feel like it was working on its own. And then I had written this other thing about Theodosia, and I brought it back. I brought the two things together, and then things started to happen finally after many years of trying to make one or the other work.
Did that marriage strike you all at once, middle of the night, wake you up?
No, actually, it was that, you know, it's one of those things like you've done everything else out of frustration. You think, okay, well, here's this thing. I found this, and this seems to be set in the Outer Banks, and this one also is set in the Outer Banks. So why don't we put them together and see what happens? But I think actually most writers that I know, and certainly most poets, have several ideas or several themes, or not necessarily themes, but stories, like present action lines that they put together to create one story, because you know novels are never about one thing. They always have very relevant but sort of separate subplots and motifs that are going on at once.
It's interesting that you thought your story about these three people who were on this island in contemporary times, 1970, for instance, had organically a longer time span. There were edges to this thing, and of course, in your novel now, The Watery Part of the World, The two women on the island are actually descendants of Theodosia. So
right.
So there is a lineage. They're really connected. I think they probably weren't. Certainly we don't know that in real life, but that doesn't matter. That's not the fact. So tell us about them, about these three people left on the island in 1970.
Mm-hmm. The two sisters are very different. One of them is, the older sister is, well, like, I guess the stereotypical older sister, in that she's sort of controlling and she wants to be in charge. And she's also very emotionally closed off. I mean, her world is extremely black and white, and it's based on, making do on the island, and also appearance. And the younger sister is a lot looser and more imaginative and more passionate. Her part of the story really deals with a long affair that she has with a guy who's much younger, and who wants her to leave the island. And she finally works up the courage to leave the island and try to find him. And things don't work out so well for her, because I think finally she ultimately makes a decision that that's not the right thing for her, and that she can't leave that place. But both sisters and Woodrow, the guy who takes care of them, are dealing with essentially the same question, which is, should I stay or should I go, to quote The Clash. I mean, that's really at the heart of it. You know, what is this island? Who am I when I'm on this island? Who might I be if I left this island? What are the risks that what am I going to give up if I leave this place? And is this even a place, or is it a construct that I've put, that I put forth so that I'll feel safe?
Right. And you're clearly, as readers, you're all just cheering them off the island. You can't imagine why anyone, particularly Woodrow Thornton, who would not have stayed. He lost his wife. You should tell us perhaps more of his background and his relationship. It is certainly a tense relationship with the two sisters.
Yeah. I mean, the novel stretches to like 1970. So in the latter part, Woodrow's still there. Civil rights movement has already started going. He's obviously aware of that. He sort of understands that he doesn't need to do this anymore, but yet he does. And I think he does it out of a weird allegiance to the place itself and out of a kind of stubbornness also. I mean, his wife wanted to leave the island. He did not. He felt very comfortable there, and he felt that was where they should stay. He finally does leave the island for the weekend. A storm comes and takes her away. He comes back to find the island changed because his wife is no longer there. He feels, I think, incredibly guilty about what he does and his role in her death, but not guilty enough to leave, in a sense, because I think that makes him in some ways even more determined to stay there and to make the place his own.
I have to say, in my sense, it was almost guilt that kept him there. Yes. I can't abandon this place now,
right,
after all I've done, even though he holds those sisters partly responsible or thinks they might have been able to do more for his wife.
Yeah, and they could have done more. I mean, I think Maggie's motivation for not saving Sarah was completely, bogus. She understood that if Sarah was saved, then Sarah might take Woodrow off the island. And if Sarah took Woodrow off the island, then she would have to leave the island because she would have no one to take care of her. Right? All the things that Woodrow does are indispensable. And that's the society. Even though there's three people, there's this hierarchy. There's this, not so subtle racist, you live over here on this side of the island, and you're across the creek, and you do these things, and we're going to be over here, and we'll meet together, and we'll have some sort of community, but we're not equal. So,
it's fascinating to me when you think about the transitions that take place. Theodosia comes to the island unwillingly and makes a psychological adjustment and becomes and is able to cope. She becomes the place. Over multiple generations, people have adapted to the place, but are psychologically unsuited and can't leave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're having sort of the reverse problem, and it's because, in a sense, my sense was that they just can't get their head around being someplace else. They wouldn't be who they are. And certainly Theodosia wouldn't have volunteered to go there.
Well, that's definitely true. But I think it's also something about the nature of the island, which is, of course, metaphorical in that it's always leaving and always staying. I mean, the Outer Banks are so fickle and so dependent entirely upon wind and water and sand. And, I mean, obviously I was trying to make a not-so-subtle point about the way in which our own identity and our own constructed identities are subject to, things that are not fixed. and that depend entirely upon emotional responses and psychic health and all kinds of things. So, that island, again, is so central to their way of understanding themselves.
Will you read for us again?
Certainly. I'll read a section that occurs when Woodrow, who, again, has been sent off island to pick up a dress in an island across the way, which actually has stores, returns to the island after the storm. Woodrow went up to the church. Maggie followed as far as Whaley's front yard. He felt her about to say something, and then he felt her think better of it. It was that quiet after the storm, on the island and in Woodrow's head. The shock of imagining Sarah's last hours cleared everything out of his head. Nothing much either in his heart. He did not feel anything walking alone now up the hill to the church. He did not notice the debris in the way, and he walked over planks and shingles and gill nets and broken glass and chicken wire. He did not see the watermark on the side of the old post office where the surge crested. One of Whaley's sheep lay drowned in the front yard of the Salter place, and he did not see nor smell it. He could not see his shoes sucking into the mud. Somehow, breath came in and out of him. She was laid out on the altar 3 steps above the crust of mud and swollen hymnals and trash left behind when the sea said enough and took its leave. It appeared to Woodrow the sea itself and not one of his white women's sisters had laid her out, then went right back to wherever it came from or wherever it was off to next. He'd rather this than anyone touching her, especially those who let her die.
Michael Parker reading from his latest novel, The Watery Part of the World. There's another relationship. I mean, the fact that that Woodrow goes often on the island, they're not totally isolated, and the offshore folks come to them. There's a relationship between Woodrow, the Whaley sisters, and a group of people known only as the tape recorders.
Right.
Tell us about them.
Well, the tape recorders are obviously sort of oral historians coming down from the universities, and they're pretty important, I think, in the book, in the way the book is structured, because I really wanted the individual sections from each of the characters to be, in a sense, a refutation of what the tape recorders take away. We all assume that oral history is much more valid and true than written history because it allows people to speak for themselves. But, you know, there's a lot to be said for the way in which a question is pitched. As you know, as an interviewer, you're well aware of the power that you have. It's true that when people talk, that instead of you writing what they say, then there's a kind of purity and a kind of spontaneity to it. But also, you know, a lot of times, and I have to say I'm an academic, but I think this is somewhat true of academia, you find what you go looking to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tape recorders are not, I mean, they're sincere, and they are not evil people, but they're not also all that open to hearing exactly what went on. So that the book, in fact, is what you don't get from the tape recorders. It's what the tape recorders are not interested in hearing, which is the real gritty, passionate, horrific, and beautiful moments of these people's lives.
Yeah, because it's true. If when you ask the question, you hear what you wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
When you answer the question, you say not what necessarily is the truth, but what you want people to think is the truth. So
mm-hmm.
If you want to get the truth, you got to sail around that whole island,
right,
which you have done beautifully. And I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Michael Parker is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His new novel is called The Watery Part of the World. He's going to read and sign copies of the book on April 27th at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. That's at 7 o'clock. Then on May 1st, he's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh. That's at 2. And for more information and other book tour dates, you can visit workman.com/Algonquin. Coming up next, folk rock, sounds of humble tripe. Stay with us on The State of Things.